Thus the sage knows without traveling, sees without looking, acts without doing. Lao Tzu, Tao Te Ching. Most famously, Pascal's declaration that has dogged me longest. All of humanity's problems stem from man's sick inability to sit quietly in a room alone. I first read that baleful line living at home during college, itching to get out. The stereotypic Midwestern frustration. Though I didn't know I was a type. How original I thought my angst was. Let me out of here. I thought the world, which I called inwardly the great world, was not the problem. Home was the problem. The world, aka freedom, was the solution. These sour discouragements against setting forth, getting into the fray or the circus or whatever is out there, have sounded wise to me at one time or another against my wanderlust will. Perhaps that was inevitable. I was taught, trained, as they said, by cloistered nuns, paradoxically the first independent women I knew, and still the most vivid in memory. The only place they live anymore, Regina, Peron, Immaculata, Mary Gertrude, Maria Cheli, all gone to glory, and none to take their places. We caught a glimpse of their mysterious lives behind the filmy black curtain dividing the cloister from our side of the chapel. Enclosure, silence, chanted Latin murmurings. It was romantic and dead serious. They were staying in their rooms, cells, watching the world make all its mistakes, praying and forgiving, waiting for the next madness so they could pray and forgive some more. There was the sense that precisely because they weren't out there, they saw it all. Observation was not an act of experience, but of the imagination. This made perfect sense. From the limitation of their enclosure, absurdly, they saw everything. Even their lack of experience was impressive, a badge of higher knowledge. "Sister," a girl asked on a fine May morning, "can we have class outside in the courtyard? Will you give us the green light?" The ancient nun, a tiny leprechaun, she hailed from Boston and wanted us in Minnesota to pronounce Ben as Bean, looked mystified, but corrected the girl's grammar first. May you have class outside. Then to the question itself. What do you mean, dear? A green light, she asked mildly. She'd been in the cloister over 50 years and had never seen a traffic light. We were not disdainful. We were impressed, as if prehistory stood before us alive and breathing. They wore habits designed in the 16th century by their foundress, before the invention of buttons or hooks. Buttons were invented? They were forever replacing a straight pin to anchor a wimple or a veil. It was a graceful gesture, the hands light and deft, fluttering around the fabric, white linen, black serge. The folds of the gowns were heavy, cut with couture severity, often patched tidily. They stayed in place. Habits, veils, long lives in their minimalist cells. The idea was to stay put, keep your lip buttoned, while the secret door or window of the heart-mind opened of its own volition to reality. Stay. Don't seek. Let it all come at you, rolling or writhing. And yet, our most ancient metaphor says, life is a journey. Not to mention the flyover Midwestern heart beating to get out. Midwesterners give over to the fiction of flight passionately. The desire to be elsewhere is the native trait. Flyover, fly away. We must set out, often without a destination, with only the instinct to search as a direction. Literature and religion are predicated on the notion of journey, movement. Pilgrimage is called in religion, plot in literature. Life's deepest pursuit is understood as a trudge. Moses on the 40-year desert camping trip. Even Jesus isn't just nailed to the cross. He treks the way of the cross to achieve Golgotha. The Hajj to Mecca. And the Buddha? He doesn't start by sitting. First, he roams. Life is a journey. A hopeless cliché, but not its fault. Cliché is the fate of every fully absorbed truth. The stars, for example, do look like diamonds. You just can't say so. Even storytelling, our simplest way to escape, begins with a journey. Dante, in exile roaming with Virgil. And English literature, my major in college, still my major, it seems, starts with the Canterbury Tales ambling along the first English narrative pathway. The journey is plotless, mimicking life with its refusal to organize itself into a coherent narrative arc. The Canterbury Tales is a series of stories, tall tales, beads strung on the thread of regional pilgrimage. Our literature begins as group tourism. Real people, the randy wife of Bath, the impoverished knight, fabricate their fictions to amuse each other on their supposedly nonfiction way from South London to coastal Kent to venerate a saint. And of course, to get away, just to escape. The pilgrimage is as much away as toward. One that aprile with the shore of salt of the draught of marsh hath burst to the rota, and bathed every vein in sweet liqueur, of which vertu engendre is a fleur. Then longen folk to go on pilgrimages and palmers, for to seek a strange strondeth. Springtime, after a winter cooped up and everyone wants to hit the road, those medieval tourists, the palmers who had already made the big pilgrimage to Jerusalem and returned with their palm frond souvenirs, even they seek strange strondes, shores as far afield as they can manage. It's deep, this instinct to move, and never satisfied. But if leisure, the leisure that promotes the life of the mind, is what's missing from our overamped world, if the rich multitasked life is the problem, shouldn't a person stay put? Lie low? This is the dilemma, my dilemma, maybe an essential contemporary middle-class dilemma. To stay or to go? Be Pascal or be Chaucer? If you're a seeker, and who opening a book is not, isn't the open road the only way, paradoxically, to find the lost life of daydream where all the rest, wisdom, decency, generosity, compassion, joy, and plain honesty are sequestered? If life is a journey, has it just become a getaway to somewhere warm on JetBlue? How to be a pilgrim without being either a tourist or worse, a pious trekker, lugging freeze-dried soup on your back, believing it's all about getting away, especially from other people. Not my problem. I don't want to get away from anyone. I want someone back. But that can't happen. What would it be like to believe we'd meet again, he and I? Heaven, life after life. One trip I can't imagine. The beautiful hand that held mine all those years. Gone. Gone for good. Strange phrase. What's good about it? Dust now. Ashes, in fact. But the biblical word insists, for dust thou art, and unto dust shalt thou return. As if to make the point. We're not simply reduced to our burnt leftovers. We return to the earth, become the anonymous stuff of the planet. To travel, to get away from absence. That's more like it. Not to get away from someone or anyone. Not even to get away from sadness, the sweet melancholy that makes so much poetry. though maybe to avoid the kindly pity so generously offered. The road, then, not the room. Back to the notebooks, the stash I've been added to methodically, like a retirement fund building all these years, a diverse portfolio of growth stocks. Many of them collapsed to nothing. Tehran, out. Even Marcus Aurelius, once such a strong contender, strikes me now as a tedious bluffer. There, winking from one notebook to another, but mostly ignored and unquoted, popping up now like a friend I keep meaning to reestablish contact with, is the boy with bold ideas and opinions beyond his years, followed up the 16th century chateau staircase by his lute player, Michel Montaigne, sluggish, lax, drowsy. This is the writer, midway between Chaucer's pilgrimage in the 14th century and Kafka's reclusiveness in the 20th, who chooses to sit in a cold stone tower and see what will roll or writhe his way. Yet Montaigne reports that he is most alive on his horse, galloping on the road in all weathers. I don't portray being. I portray passing. He doesn't mean the passage of eras of history, his long broken arc. He means movement, minute to minute, the inner tick-tock of thought. He means he portrays, paints is the added meaning of the word in French, what passes through the mind, his own. Follow him, then, the first modern. So go, and also stay. To go. Program for pilgrimage, squeezing the lemon of location for all it's worth, looking for meaning, the last drop left over from the lived life of others. Location, 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 as if life were fundamentally a real estate transaction. My own life list, as birders say of their sightings, is long. Freud's house at Berggasse 19 in Vienna. Been there, wrote it up. Leaving the flat, annoyed that the effort of finding the building, it was not yet on the tourist track, hadn't been worth the trouble. Then, pausing on the clammy staircase, dark moss and springy lichen in the shadowy corner, the dart of realization, the sensation that just here, on the turn of the stone landing, his patience must have stopped too, pivoting from the session back into their real or feigned lives. I had stumbled, I felt sure, on the locus of many revelations. Later, I tracked the couch to Hampstead. But he wasn't there. The landing outside the Vienna flat was where he was to be found, head turned away, white hair thinning, faint odor, a chewed cigar. But of course, it was just the sodden scent of rain from earlier in the day. Closer to home, a road trip to Iowa to find Dvorak, wandering around the Turkey River, tiny tributary of the Mississippi, to visit the Czech-settled farm town of Spillville, where he spent the summer of 1893, hoping to hear, as he had, the scarlet tanager drilling the motif of the scherzo of the American Quartet. Didn't find the bird, but amazingly found Dvorak, a stump by the Turkey River, where he sat, listening, getting the local boys to flush birds for him. His pretty daughter, Otilka, fancied a kickaboo drummer. That was the end of the family's unlikely summer in Iowa. I sussed a book out of that, too. Another time, another project, off to Greece and Turkey, in the footsteps of St. Paul, as I wrote in the proposal for a travel grant. Went there to find the narrative for a book. But I decided, after all, to leave Paul to the scholars and wrote nothing, asking the guide as we drove on and on in the little top-heavy van, from Tarsus to Antioch, along the eastern Mediterranean, from Iconium to Perga, on to Ephesus. Did Paul walk all this? Yes, all this, 100% for sure. Hours later, still in the van, the dun-colored dust coating the glass rectangle I looked out, the crunch of stone when the tires veered to the edge. And this hallway, too? Yes, I tell you, all this, on foot, all this, 100% for sure. I closed my eyes, curled up in my seat, flummoxed by such zeal, glad of the AC. The Galilee? Made that trip, too, against the advice of the fretful. Isn't that near the Golan Heights? Do you think you should... Believe it or not, Jesus was there. Lake Kinneret, smooth as a rink that June afternoon, easily walkable. A boat set off in the distance. Slap, slap. The distant sound of fisherfolk, as if a figment of Minnesota's wild rice waterways had followed me to that arid place, always at home near a fishing lake. He had not been in Jerusalem amid the smoky votive lights of the Armenian watchdogs of the sepulchre, but I should not have been surprised to find him on the pristine shores near Capernaum. Nor was this a Christian theme park. It seemed untouched. Timeless. His. Oh, no, said the Catholic priest who was showing me around. Oh, no, the Israelis would never let anyone junk this up. It provides a big percentage of the drinking water for the country. Sacred water because secular water. An even better miracle these days than water into wine. Water into water. Like that. But for some reason, I never wrote up that agreeable irony, except in my notebook, the slag heap of the annotated life, tossed along paths abandoned or never taken. Honestly wasted moments, as so many details deserve to be, even when they are given their humble habitation on the private page. Let them get lost in their unnumbered diary pages. There is, as well, an even longer list of saints I sought. A bus from Paris to Lisieux to find the tubercular Carmelite, Thérèse, author of the first autobiography of my girlhood, sending showers of roses from heaven after her death at 24. I took hers for my confirmation name, Patricia Mary Thérèse, mainly for the Frenchy accents. I fostered a taste for youthful death and dreamed of going to Lima to see the bed of broken bricks St. Rose slept on in a hut behind her family's grand mansion, a life of ardent denial. All the jewels, rubies, sapphires, she refused to wear. Her furious father. That trip never happened. My Lives of the Saints period petered out before I achieved Latin America. But I made it to Assisi for Francis, the best saint of them all. He got a whole book from me. The following year, off to England, to Norwich for St. Julian, the anchoress confined to her little cell, a carbuncle stuck on the side of the Church of St. Julian. Hence her name. No one really knows who she was, she with her mystic visions. Julian and her sole companion, a little cat, who was always at her feet in pictures and statuary, the tail neatly rounding his upright body. The showings came to her in fits, and then, convalescing, she wrote them down. T.S. Eliot quotes her at the end of the Four Quartets, as if her 14th century assurance that all shall be well, all manner of things shall be well, could assuage the savage wounds of the 20th. Then, naturally enough, on to Anne Frank. Up early, ahead of everyone, that cold spring morning in Amsterdam, I was the first to lumber up the narrow staircase, getting the room to myself for 5 minutes before the world crowded in behind me, mostly school children on a field trip. I hardly realized all these trips were pilgrimages, sometimes spiritual, more often secular, hajjas to the homes or haunts of figures I knew or felt I knew, people who flared alive in my mind from reading. They seemed to invite me from the page to call on them, as if they were there, a trace at least, A literary bloodhound on the prowl, not for ghosts, but for leftover life. Evidence. Of what? History? Evidence of the combustible urgency of the soul? But then what is travel but a search for what has preceded us, a personage, a habitation? Whitman was wrong about that. The open road isn't open. At least it isn't vacant. Even a hike or a canoe trip into wilderness that seems to be outside history, repudiating human narrative, even such travel, is a search for before, the trace of an ancient tree. Precambrian rock, rare lady slipper orchid in a reclusive swamp, the pristine location sought by the naturalist is a figment of time immemorial. Virgin history, before we made up history, but history, nonetheless. The first time I went to England after graduate school, I had to remind myself, there will be cars, skyscrapers, fast food. My England was a set design by Jane Austen, George Eliot, and my great favorite, Thackeray. Literature had been my elsewhere long before I left St. Paul. In London, that first trip, I choked on a nut sandwich in a vegetarian tea shop built into William Blake's house and had time to think before someone smacked me on the back and I was saved. Geez, I'm dying, where Blake wrote his poems. In time, writers overtook the saints and became a different canon. Catherine Mansfield in Bandol, Hemingway at his standing desk in Key West, all those cats catting around. Then Hampstead again, this time for Keats, also Guy's Hospital for him. And finally, as he did, off to Rome, the little room overlooking the Spanish Steps where he died. Tourists in shorts and cartoonish running shoes lined up on the steps eating ice cream. An American undergrad laughing to his buddy, leaping past the window of the bedroom, taking the steps two at a time, yelling, "Fuck no! Fuck, man!" Later to Amherst for Emily Dickinson's house and the gravesite, called home. Along the promenade in Brooklyn for Whitman, reading Crossing Brooklyn Ferry. And a blistering hot July afternoon in the cool library of Indiana University for Sylvia Plath's baby book. Her mother's itty-bitty control-freak handwriting telling you all you needed to know about where her frightful ambition was hatched. I almost never travel for a vacation. I take off for commemorative or even funerary experience, as if all the world were a vast and not cheerless cemetery, the ghosts still murmuring if you can get close enough. Well, most of them, even the saints, were writers, so the words are audible as you move from room to room of their houses or through the gardens. Rye House Garden for Henry James. I sweet-talked my way in there on a day when it was closed, taking the train from London. James was my hero of the notebook, not of the novel. If one was to undertake to tell tales and to report with truth on the human scene, he said in his wonderfully overstuffed way, it could but be because notes had been from the cradle the ineluctable consequence of one's greatest inward energy. To take them was as natural as to look, to think, to feel, to recognize, to remember. I sought out Rye House, pledging my allegiance to the note, the shard, the fragment, the bit that glints in the dirt and makes the book possible. I knew even then I didn't believe in the narrative arc, that fiction of fiction. I've even contrived to live in a shrine myself, though I didn't plan it or realize it when I moved in years ago. Scott Fitzgerald's St. Paul, his grandmother's slice of a witchy old row house in the old Cathedral Hill neighborhood, my home these last 36 years. It was a sad sack crumbling place when I arrived, a heartbreak hotel without children or pets, housing an array of fixed income tenants, a defrocked priest, the physician who'd lost his license but not his thirst for Canada rye, an array of maiden, divorced, widowed ladies, hard to tell the category of loneliness. One, a woman who wondered if I would be interested in seeing a letter from Willa Cather she had received as a girl. Maybe it was worth something? Did I know? Not that she would ever part with it, absolutely not, as if I had asked to buy it. Astrology magazines came regularly for several of them, their only apparent mail. I was surprised to find next door the retired lay teacher from my old high school. She taught Spanish, not my language. I belonged to France, and Sister Perrin Marie, the cloistered nun who taught us how to use the Paris Metro, from a grid she mimeoed and gave to each of us. Girls, how do we get from Invalides to Marché aux Puces at Porte de Clignancourt? What are the transfer points? The old Spanish teacher greeted me warily, with shy hope as I lugged my boxes of books and not much else up to the second floor. Do you like scotch, dear? Before long, the museum curators and the psychotherapists began buying up the old heaps. This is the neighborhood, in fact, the very block, where Jonathan Franzen opens his novel, Freedom. Earnest young couples acquiring abandoned mansions for a song, ruining their marriages with too much infidelity and paint stripping. For all my gallivanting, I've never left. I'll get to that, too. It's part of the love story, the beautiful hand that held mine. He had the apartment on the first floor as I trudged up to the second with my boxes of books. My girlfriend, helping me move, said excitedly, "There's the most interesting-looking man in the first-floor apartment. His door was open. Maybe you'll meet him." The quotation is exact. Strange that it imprinted itself. Though I said, "Are you kidding?" I was just breaking up with a boyfriend. I wasn't looking for Mr. Wright. I didn't believe there was such a person. But there you are, the downstairs neighbor, introducing yourself the next morning. Bright October, crisp and fresh. The city of St. Paul was planting a tree, a laurel tree, below my window just then. I have a graduate degree in lyric poetry, I thought. I know a symbol when I see one. Putting down roots. I was holding the teacup, smiling, when there was a knock on the door. You. Would I like to be shown where the garbage bins were? The location was a little tricky, you said. I followed you into the alley behind a rickety arbor fence, listened intently. As you said, the landlord required everything to be tied up in plastic bags. I was trying to think of something else I could ask you to tell me about. So we began. The first cup of coffee. The new life, within 24 hours of the old. The life, now ended. The hand, now dust. Dust, but it must be said, gold dust. Memory glints. The laurel tree is huge now. Should be pruned. The bark cracked, but still alive. Now high school students come to the building on assignment, snapping Instagrams to prove to their teachers that they've made the assigned circuit of the Fitzgerald locations. The birth house is three blocks up the street. It seems the English teachers insist on these pilgrimages, apparently more essential than reading the books. I often find a teenager on our staircase. More pilgrims, believers in the unreal estate of history-touched locations. I see I'm not alone in this. So I'll make the rounds, take my notes, the ineluctable consequence of one's greatest inward energy. On a tour of the heroes of leisure, confined till now in my stack of notebooks, but out there, part of the great world. I'm ready to roll. Carry-on bag, Montaigne, all of him, on the iPhone. Off I go, looking for ease, if not my own ease. That's gone, along with you. Reason enough to head out. On the night of Monday, March 30th, 1778, an Anglo-Irish lady named Sarah Ponsonby, age 23, the unmarried dependent of well-placed relatives, her parents long dead, slipped out of her guardian's Georgian mansion in Woodstock, Kilkenny, the rest of the house asleep. She was dressed in men's clothing, had a pistol on her, and carried her little dog, Frisk. She made her way to the estate's barn, where Lady Eleanor Butler, a spinster 16 years her senior, a member of one of the beleaguered old Catholic dynasties of Ireland, the Dukes, later the Earls of Ormond, was awaiting her, having decamped from Stony Butler Castle 12 miles distant on a borrowed horse. She, too, was wearing men's breeches and a topcoat. Their plan, long schemed, was to ride through the night, the moon a bare sliver, to Waterford, 23 miles away on the coast, and from there to embark for England to live together somewhere, they had no exact destination, in delicious seclusion. Their goal was retirement, a life of sentiment and tenderness. Their alarmed relatives followed in panicked pursuit, intercepting them in a barn where they had sheltered overnight when they missed the packet boat. It is thought they were given away by the frantic yapping of Frisk. They were hauled back to their respective homes, where Sarah, having caught a cold in the barn, advanced the plot of their Gothic tale by falling seriously ill with fever. Her life hung in the balance, but not her determination. The sweet-tempered, seemingly tractable Sarah told her guardians that were she denied her desire to live and die with Miss Butler, such a refusal would, according to a correspondent of her distressed guardian, Lady Betty Fownes, provoke her to an act that would give her friends more trouble than anything she had yet done. A wiry will was coiled under her mild demeanor, betraying a capacity to perform acts more bold than the purse crocheting she was known for in the Fownes' salon. As Sarah recovered over the next month, she and Lady Eleanor wore down their dismayed relatives. Everyone was comforted that at least there was no man concerned with either of them, as Lady Betty put it with some relief, if deeper perplexity. Finally, with the two families apparently played out by the intransigence they faced, the two friends were allowed to leave Ireland together on a lovely May morning in a fashion less romantic but more commodious than their attempted escape some weeks before. They were provided with a coach to the seaport and were accompanied by a butler housemaid, Mary Carroll. It was reported they were laughing merrily as they stepped into the coach. The plot was yet richer. Sarah Ponsonby's guardian, Sir William Fownes, had confessed his passion for her in the midst of the upheaval. He entreated her, down on his knee, to stay in Kilkenny. He had been rather counting on Lady Betty's poor health to release him before long, thinking himself something of a catch. He was just over 50, and allowed that he considered himself to have a pretty face. He still hoped to provide a male heir to the family baronetcy. Poor Lady Betty, having managed only a daughter, now grown and married, with children of her own in Dublin. Sarah Ponsonby had come into the household thanks to Betty, her kind-hearted elder cousin, who had taken in the orphan girl, originally against the grumpy objections of the later smitten Sir William. Lady Betty seems to have been exhausted by the romantic upheaval of it all. Her response to her husband's passion and Sarah's horrified rebuff was to leap over all these unruly emotions and head straight for the comforts of the grave, writing her dear Sir William a letter without a note of outrage or betrayal, outlining her burial wishes with housewifely economy. "I've always meant to be a good wife and mother, and hope you think me so. As to my funeral, I hope you'll all allow me to be buried as I like, which is this. When the women about me are sure I am dead, I would be carried to the church and kept out of ground 2 days and nights, four women to sit up with me, nobody to be at my funeral but my own poor, who I think will be sorry for me. Lady Betty proved to be prescient, though her order backwards. While the ladies were touring Wales looking for a place to retire in delicious seclusion, Sir William succumbed to a stroke, though not before he was cupped, blistered, and glistered in the medical method of the day. As he feared, the family baronetcy was extinct with his death. Lady Betty, with her weak heart, soon followed. They were buried side by side in the little Church of Ireland graveyard near their Woodstock home. Lady Eleanor and Sarah Ponsonby, careering around the countryside near the River Dee, looking for their ideal retreat, were blissfully unaware of this sad Irish epilogue to their own happy Welsh ending, or their beginning, as it proved to be. The ladies, as they were known in Llangollen, and are known still, for of course I went there, settled themselves and proceeded to pass 50 years in their Welsh vale, living the hyper-domesticated retirement they had dreamed of in Ireland. They soon became celebrated. They were famous for wishing to be left alone. In pursuing the ladies in Llangollen, I was not discovering them, though no one I mentioned them to had heard of them. I was picking up a trail first laid down by their intrigued contemporaries 2 centuries earlier. During the ladies' long years in their home, called Plas Newydd, it seems just about everyone beat a path to the heavily ornamented Gothic door of their remote cottage. Wordsworth and Southey composed poems under its low roof. Both Shelley and Byron turned up to talk and stare, apparently flummoxed by the orderly, cloistered life of the ladies. Charles Darwin came as a child in the company of his father. Lady Caroline Lamb, the novelist and lover of Lord Byron, and a distant relative of Sarah, made a visit. As did Sir Walter Scott. Even the Duke of Wellington, a treasured friend, and De Quincey, coldly received. On and on, the personages of the age made pilgrimage to the isolated Welsh village on the River Dee. Josiah Wedgwood visited the ladies to tour and opine about the rock formations of the surrounding savage landscape. The two most celebrated virgins in Europe became, with their pastoral life, both a model and a curiosity. The poet Anna Seward, known as the Swan of Lichfield, visited and corresponded with the ladies. Various royals from the continent also made the pilgrimage, the aunt of Louis XVI, Prince Esterhazy from Budapest. Coming and going, the aristocrats paid wistful or baffled homage to a way of life rare in its independence and chosen affection. Some visitors spent the night at Plas Newydd, though this was not favored by the reclusive ladies who valued their quiet night's adieu, tucked up by the fire made up by Mary Carroll, reading aloud to each other from French novels. They directed visitors to put up at the Hand, the Llangollen Inn, still open for business today in a wan sort of way, a big barny hotel where, a sign indicates, the Llangollen Rotary Club meets every Monday, 5 p.m., save for bank holidays. The ladies called on the Hand when they needed to hire a coach, but Eleanor and Sarah rarely required a coach. They stayed home. That was the point, or part of their point. The retired life was the cloistered life. Secular nuns. No wonder I begin my not very leisurely tour of leisure with them. "You and your nuns," he used to say, charmed in his amused non-Catholic way by my nun thing. He loved to call out in mock horror from the living room if I was in the kitchen. "Oh, no, the nun story is on public TV again tonight." Cue my reply. "I have 3 words for you, mister. Super Bowl Sunday." All the ways we contrived over the years, over all the differences, to say, "Crazy about you. Just crazy about you." Within 5 years of their taking up residence in Llangollen, the lady's renown was so far advanced that the queen was asking to see the plans of their cottage and garden. The plans were lost or perhaps discarded. Queen Charlotte was known to abhor the scent of musk, the very perfume the ladies lavished on their linens and all correspondence sent from Place Neuve. Anything posted from the cottage was redolent of their signature funky fragrance. But in spite of the musk, the word from those who visited was that the cottage and environs were beguiling, and the ladies themselves enchantresses. Llangollen is hardly a straight shot from London, even today. It might have been easier to hire a coach in the 18th century to visit the ladies at Place Neuve. I used public transport, not trusting my American self to drive on the left side of the road without him in the passenger seat, saying without alarm, "Left, darling, left," when, not if, I made a turn into the right lane. After the train from London Euston to Chester, 2 hours, a branch line train to a place called Rowton that appeared to be an abandoned station. The next step was a bus. Where was that? No one around to ask. I lugged my roller bag across the railroad overpass and wandered out to a roadway, overjoyed to see a bus stop a block up the way with a weather-beaten sign. Cars, not many, went by, a truck or two. Finally, the bus. And was told I was standing on the wrong side of the road for the bus to Llangollen. Opposite side, love. It felt like a time warp. Merry old England. Cup of tea. Well, this was Wales. The road signs were in Welsh, bigger, and English, underneath, as if to make clear what mattered in these parts. It was late afternoon by the time I got to Llangollen, the bus dropping me by the river on the edge of the action. Casino, hotels offering teas, B&Bs to the left, hotels to the right. A tourist town, not because of the ladies. I seemed to be alone in coming to the little town on the River Dee to find them. Hiking, biking, whitewater rafting, a steam train chugging along an otherwise abandoned track, to be had for an afternoon outing. Canal boats and horse cart rides, families and young cyclists streaking by in the eely, skin-tight garments they wear, and their reverse number, retired couples, not the soulful retirement the ladies sought, on modest walking tours, lumbering along, stopping for afternoon cake, drinks before the beef dinner, or up to the romantic ruins of Valcrucus, the outing the ladies sometimes undertook with their visitors. I had a reservation at a hotel I had chosen for the name, the Falls, assuming it must overlook the river, picking up on Josiah Wedgwood's fascination with the area's wild landscape. It soon became evident I should have chosen the cornerstone directly across the street. It had the river view. The entry door of the Falls was locked. The attached wine bar closed. I bumped my roller bag across to the cornerstone. It looked like an illustration for the old curiosity shop, mullioned windows, dark interior. In a trice, fairy tale fast, the door was opened by the owner, who introduced herself as Carol. "Come in, come in, cold as winter, hardly any kind of June day." She took charge of the roller bag and me. "You'll want tea? Taste for cake?" I was told to sit by the fire and fell into a voluminous sofa deep with oversized pillows. I'm not sure what a peat fire is, but I think this was a peat fire, the smell of something danker than a wood log, heavy with compounded forest. Lap of comfort, if not luxury. Tea and a hard little cake, meant to be dipped, dip it, my dear, arrived on a tray, milk, demerara, sugar cubes, thin paper napkin. "Did Carol know about the ladies?" "Oh, yes, quite the pair, they." As for the owner of the Falls, she did not wish to speak ill, neighbors, friends, cross the divide, all that, but, well, where was he? Allowing herself a professional shrug. "What do you expect? Didn't live on the premises. She lived." on the premises. Unfortunately, the cornerstone was entirely booked. Pity. I felt a stab of disappointment, as if the ladies who had brought me all this way had cozied up together by their peat fire, reading La Nouvelle Heloise to each other, and then dispatched me to the hand. I was nicely settled in by the cornerstone fire when the owner of the falls, located on his cell phone by Carol, arrived on the sidewalk and put his face to the mullion, the little square window filled with his big head. He spotted me in the cheerful dark, dipping my brittle cake into the milky tea. In he bounded. It was my fault, somehow, that I had not located him. Not that it mattered, he said. Come along, then. A nod to Carol, and we were off. She wouldn't accept payment for the tea. Glad to take in a stray. Come any time. It was raining now, the owner blustering across the street. Come along. My room was on the third floor of an old building, many coats of stucco whited over. Narrow staircase, the roller bag bumping behind me, the room larger than I expected, with a sloping floor, double bed, the mattress cratering toward the center, everything clean and orderly, dried flowers, only slightly dusty on the mantle of the fireplace. No, entirely bricked up. No fire is here, I'll tell you. It was the tatty look I remembered from my first trips to England in the 1970s. Keats, Blake, Wordsworth. Decor meant to convey hominess, but experienced as dispiriting. Too bad I was missing the wine bar, the owner was saying. Best wine bar in town, he didn't mind claiming. But closed Sundays. Try the corn mill, he suggested, and pointed the way. Bit of a trek in the rain, but who's afraid of a little damp? There you go. The corn mill was a stylish place, fitted into, what else, an abandoned stone corn mill, repurposed as a restaurant overlooking the Dee. Bar downstairs, mostly young people, loud and happy. Upstairs, in the quiet restaurant, I found a corner table with a small window to myself, almost as cozy as the cornerstone by the peat fire with my tea and cake. I looked down at the river, billowing with mist, the rain steady now, the night lowering. Imagine Eleanor and Sarah arriving about the same time of year. Spring can be cold, the rain penetrating. No wonder they loved their fire. Strangers here, but not, at least, alone. Why is it still so hard to enter a restaurant on my own, take a table, settle into the business of dinner, as if eating alone were faintly reprehensible? My mother's voice homing in as I lie under Mr. Kenny's beechnut tree. Well, it's sad, darling. He drinks alone. And me, waiting for a glass of wine. It's a feminist thing. I know. I've read the articles in the women's magazines, how you must walk right in, take possession, and don't let them park you next to the kitchen door. The woman who dines alone. The postmodern valor I struggle to claim. I've never had this anxiety about traveling alone, which I've done for years. But the barricade of a good restaurant for dinner, lunch, strangely, poses no problem. For that, I must suit up. The armor covering my unease is always a book tucked in my purse, as if I packed a pearl-handled pistol. More recently, the iPhone. But somehow, a book seems more companionable. I put it on the table to my right. Security detail. Riding shotgun. The waiter arrives, sweet kid with a concerned look. He brings me my glass of wine, still frowning. Something bothering him. Maybe I shouldn't have seated myself? No, not that at all, madam. He would like to see me at a better table, the larger table, by the big window, with what he thinks, what he knows. Been here all my life, haven't I? Has the better view. Big storm coming, lightning and that. Something to see. I argued for my small table with the partial river view, and try to foist off concern for him as a reason to stay put. Won't he need the big table when the place starts to fill up? He insists on being the feminist. You're a nice lady, and you got here first, didn't you? He wins, picks up my wine glass, settles me and my book at the big table with the big window, and goes off, much relieved that things are now as they should be. The place did fill up. I held uneasily to my fiefdom with the best river view, as couples and larger groups mounted the stairs, gazing around for a good table, lowering an eye at me with my lamb. Best thing on our menu, if I may suggest. The second glass of wine, my low-grade misery, my difficulty claiming my place on planet Earth. I open my book, which is meant to prove I'm sustaining a relationship of some kind, like everybody else out for the night. I'm dining with Colette. I discovered the ladies from her. I'm rereading the chapter she devotes to them in The Pure and the Impure, the book she considered her best, the nearest I shall come to writing an autobiography. Two of Colette's biographers I've read elsewhere seem uneasy about the book being her best, saying it displays a certain incoherence, Joanna Richardson, and the prose is rather cryptic, Judith Thurman. In this book about the first stirrings of modernity and Colette's revisitation of her gallant, cross-dressing, lipstick lesbian youth, the ladies seem oddly placed. They get a whole long chapter. Strange to find them here. Once again, as they were in the 18th century, Lady Eleanor and Sarah are outliers, conscripted this time into a tour of early 20th century escapades from Colette's years as a vagabond, her jaunty term for her youthful, transgressive self. The book's other chapters are portraits from Colette's fin de siècle experiences, observations of the lives of those living on the wild side of desire, at the cusp between the Belle Époque and modernism, when the demi-monde was not, as it has since become, pretty much the monde entire. The book does not strike me as particularly autobiographical, at least not in the self-revealing way we expect now of memoir. Much of the fan dancing is performed well behind the fan. The Wikipedia entry for the book describes it as a novel, as do some of the readers posting responses online. Yes, I'm online. My waiter has given me the restaurant's Wi-Fi password, so I'm dining not only with Colette, but with any number of people who have opinions about her and much else. Is it really possible that Kobe Bryant has posted a Goodreads rating of The Pure and the Impure? 3 stars. A man of few words. What I've learned is that when the Goodreads description says erotic, it never is. Kobe Bryant? There he is. Or someone claiming to be Kobe Bryant and mightily disappointed in Colette. I'm heartened that Kobe Bryant confirms my thoughts. The Pure and the Impure isn't a novel, nor is Colette a reporter, as she suggests in the opening pages. The book is rich in her signature descriptive riffs, revisiting scenes and people from a life now at a distance, looking them up in memory to see if they have anything further to report on the ever-beguiling subject of desire. Festooning scenes with volleys of dialogue as if she had a tape recorder in her pocket all those years ago. But what are the ladies doing here? On this, Kobe has nothing to say. All the figures Colette describes come from her world and observation, except Eleanor and Sarah. They belong to that other history. History. The past beyond memory. The book isn't an autobiography, and the ladies' chapter isn't quite a work of history. There is nothing to call research, and of course no reporting. Instead, speculation and assumption, or presumption. The Pure and the Impure opens with a memory of a visit to an opium den where Colette claims the identity of journalist. She tells her host she is here on professional assignment, giving herself the ideal narrative cover, observer, not participant. She doesn't take the offered pipe, the pinch of cocaine. This refusal is emblematic of Colette's teasing tour of the banlieue of desire that follows. The source of the book's cryptic prose seems to be the fainting and lunging Colette performs throughout about her own sexuality. It is strange that she should invite readers to call this Now You See Me, Now You Don't book her nearest try at autobiography. But then, maybe foregrounding life's sinkholes and silences is the deepest resolve of autobiography, and not, as we tend to think, confession, display, self-revelation. The book is a scattering of prose patches held loosely together by the notion of the power of the senses. Montaigne, again, the book along the lines of these things that Montaigne, loath to be corralled into form, called his basket of thoughts and observations. Maybe such random takes on a subject, barely held together by the idea of a chapter, and certainly not comprising anything as taut as narrative, are the real destination of autobiography, not our experience as it is reeled out in stories, but the play of consciousness over the inchoate field of existence. What holds Colette's things together, if anything does, is the conundrum at their core. What is desire, and why does it rule us? Maybe, I decide, Colette abandons any pretense of autobiography or reportage and turns to the more distant region of history to grasp a life she can fashion into something more complete than a vignette, more than a shard of observation fitted into her collage of desire. She not only conscripts the ladies out of the 18th century and out of their Welsh cottage, she plunges forward, imagining them out of their century and into hers in 1930. They would own a car, wear dungarees, smoke cigarettes, have short hair, and there would be a liquor bar in their apartment. Eleanor Butler would curse as she jacked up the car and would have her breasts amputated. Anything amiss? The attentive lad who thinks I'm a nice lady, deserving of the better view, has returned. Unhappy with the lamb? I realize I've been scowling at Colette. I've put down my fork and picked up my pen. In the margin, bearing down hard next to the amputated breasts, please. He clears my plate, inquiring if I might like the pudding. I remind myself this doesn't mean chocolate custard. It's how they say dessert over here, the upper classes insisting on the nursery word. Only the working classes say dessert in an effort to sound cultivated. This I've been told by an English friend. But he has turned it around again, the working lad who has picked up the way the nice ladies talk. I say in my flat Midwestern voice, thanks, yes, I'd like dessert. It's tiramisu, he murmurs as if tending an irksome patient. And the strongest coffee you have. I want something bitter. Off he goes. I'm back with Colette and my annoyance. She feels free to make the ladies into her cartoon. They're beyond living memory, beyond witnessing. How amusing to be born in the 18th century with all its rules and regs, when in the 20th century, they could be free to tinker with a car and lop off their breasts. If they'd only lived in the 20th century, the ladies could have set up frankly as lesbians, for weren't they two women who so desired to be together, merge and love and entwine themselves, that they fled family and friends on the heroic wings of Eros? Well, no. They said they didn't elope for this reason. Even the word elopement did not have the erotic undertow in the 18th century that it has in ours. But of course, we think we know better. We know what they were really up to because, in plucking them out of their moment in space-time and understanding them into our own, we see they were lesbians.